So what happened was on the morning of October 12th, the USS Cole was docked in the port of Aden and it was refueling.
It was 120 degrees. The guys with the guns that were pointing at them were passing out. It was so hot and it was a multi-hour standoff while negotiations happened.
Back in 2000 in a country like Yemen, I mean, you're already under guard. So as FBI agents, you're already in danger.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer for CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. And I have to apologize in advance, guys. I'm not in my normal Atlanta studio, Jim. As you can see, I'm with you on the West Coast, but my sound equipment is not quite as good out here. So apologies in advance, everybody.
Well, today we have a very special guest from my past life.
Good afternoon. Hi, everybody. My name is Jane Rhodes. I, too, am a retired FBI agent. I worked with Jim over the course of my career. Previously worked in the New York office in Washington, D.C., Chicago, and Philadelphia. So I'm happy to be here today.
Thanks for coming, Jane.
Yeah, and I just want everyone to know that I did not know that Jim and Jane had past work history together when I invited Jane on the podcast. And so I'm a little bit alarmed that hashtag Team Jim is a little overwhelming today. I'm feeling very alone.
As it should be. As it should be.
I don't know, Jim. I don't know. You know, I do have like one fan who's hashtag Team Francie, so I certainly hope she's listening. I pay her well to listen and to hashtag Team Francie at every opportunity.
Well, Francie, I just don't know why you're so concerned about all this hashtag and team this and that.
Well, easy for you to say because everyone's on your side.
Well, shouldn't they be?
Actually. No, they should not.
Let's be honest. Right, Jane? Just say yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay.
See, right. I'm totally outnumbered.
Well, Jane, it's so good to see you again and so good to have you on Best Case, Worst Case. And what's really cool about it is we get to hear a really cool case story from you today. And we're going to start by asking you, where were you in your career at the time that this case came to you?
Sure. So this happened in October of 2000. At the time, I was assigned to the New York office as a special agent. I was assigned to a white collar squad, and I was also a member of the evidence response team, or what we would call in the FBI, the ERT. So I was going about my duties, combating financial crime in New York City.
I think that's really interesting, Jane. And something I'm not sure we've really talked about much on this podcast in our whole history. And that is this idea of collateral duty that FBI agents had. I'm sure lots of people have no idea that you have anything other than, you know, investigating cases as a duty. Can you talk about that just a little bit? What does that mean, collateral duty? And how did you get involved in the evidence response team?
Sure, of course. So the term is used for a variety of different, you know, specialized assignments that agents may have. So at the time, as I mentioned, I was on a white collar squad. So my primary responsibility was to investigate allegations of financial fraud, primarily impacting financial institutions or private citizens or different commercial organizations. But the work I was doing at that time wasn't perhaps the most exciting. It involved some antitrust investigations and other things that, you know, little kids don't dream about when they want to grow up to be FBI agents. So some of my friends that I knew from the office were on the New York's evidence response team. So that team would work with the New York City Police Department and with other law enforcement agencies and assist them in processing crime scenes. So the evidence response teams across the United States provide a key resource to, especially to other police departments, many of which, of course, are not as large as the New York City Police Department, and really provide additional expertise as far as collecting evidence, documenting it, using special techniques and tools that can assist in more complex crime scenes.
Jane, you're like a living, breathing advertisement for the FBI's ERT. I mean, you're really good.
Well, I pretty much am.
Yeah. Well, when I was in the New York office, I was on the ERT for 8.5 years, and I loved it because, when you got sort of in the drudgery of the day-to-day cases, and then you come home after a long day of work, and at 2 a.m, you get a call that at 3, you have to be somewhere to do a crime scene on a case. Right. It just adds excitement to your life.
It does. It does. Right. You never know that, they're looking for a body that in theory was buried inside a garage in Brooklyn, or it may have been a kidnapping victim or some other large crime scene. So that was the kind of more interesting things that I was looking for outside of, or I should say, in addition to my other.
Right. And one time when I got one of those calls, because I had become an metal detector expert for the FBI and my work in the ERT, and at one time I got this call and I had to do a search of a basement of this house. And when I got there, I, was told where they wanted me to search. I searched, I found a few machine guns and handguns, and, I handed them off to the case agent and then, moved on with my life. What I didn't know is that 6 years later, I would solve a murder because I had recovered that gun. That's another case that Francie will ask me about later. but it was amazing, the confluence of events, that I actually solved this murder because the gun used in that murder was found in that basement by me. And it was just crazy that I was assigned to the case 6 years later that gun was used for. So it was just crazy. But anyway, let's get back to your case. And what were you doing on the day and at the time that you actually first heard about this case that you're going to tell us about?
So it was in the fall. I remember it, October is a beautiful time of year. I can't remember exactly what I had done earlier in the day, but, we learned that the USS Cole, which is a Navy destroyer vessel, had been bombed in the port of Aden in Yemen. So, that was news that, just came to, everyone's attention, and that the FBI's New York international terrorism teams would be responding. And so as the afternoon, the evening progressed, then we were notified that from ERT that they were looking for volunteers of people who could go and make the trip.
Hey, so Jane, quick question. Sorry, I always interrupt people. I drive Jim crazy. So I think this is so incredible that you are going to get a call to go to Yemen. And as I'm sure you know, most Americans are woefully sort of slack in understanding world geography. Can you tell us what part of the world Aden, Yemen is in, and why the FBI would get a call to do anything outside the United States?
Right. Well, I will readily admit, at the time when they said this event had happened in Yemen, I tried to act smooth, like I knew where Yemen was, and it was like a place that I had been on spring vacation. But I too had to consult an atlas and understand where Yemen was. I'm embarrassed to say I'm not going to give you a geography lesson right now for where it is. I know it's a really long ways away. It's in the Middle East, and it is it's adjacent to some other dangerous places. So I'm going to do a better job. I'm going to look up on my phone so I sound better when you all edit that.
But that's it. It's in the Middle East. It's really far away.
Really far away. Really far away. But the reason that the FBI would respond to such matters like that is the United States federal crime, the statutes, and Francie, you can fill in the blanks here on the legal expertise, is that if a United States citizen is a victim of terrorism overseas, outside of the boundaries of the United States, the United States Department of Justice may seek charges against those people. And in those situations, the FBI is tasked to go and respond and to conduct investigations along these lines. Same thing that happened when the embassies were bombed and the Khobar Towers that were bombed in 1996 in Saudi Arabia, 1998 when the embassies were bombed. And so it is a common occurrence that FBI offices are deployed to conduct investigations overseas.
Okay, so that's really interesting, Jane. You just like the rest of us, you hear that the USS Cole has been attacked and bombed and people have been killed. American citizens, American sailors have been killed overseas, and volunteers are sought. I think that's really interesting. So you don't just get assigned. I mean, what, you know, I worked with the FBI for a long time, and just like at the Department of Justice, you can't always choose your assignments. You most often just get told, here's what you're doing tomorrow. So I think that's interesting that volunteers were sought. But so tell us a little bit about how that came about and what happened after that.
Yeah, so I think it's a combination of, you know, number one, recognizing that this was travel to a dangerous place. It's immediate travel overseas to be gone for, you don't know how long you're going to be gone for, and you're going to be gone probably at least 3 or 4 weeks. And just from a practical perspective, not everyone can do that. And so, you know, I was able to raise my hand and know that I could be gone. I was able to get my cases and turn over a couple things to some colleagues in my absence that would be able to handle them. But that's important, right? That it's a combination of people that are able to go, that are willing to go, because you don't want to get overseas and have some people that are grumpy the whole time, don't want to be there, or are just really too frightened to operate, or who really don't have their mind focused on the actual work that needs to be done. Because it was a challenging environment from both an operational perspective, just a physical perspective, and also from a danger and a threat perspective.
I agree, Jane, that working with Francie is a a very challenging thing, but I rise above it all the time. It's just my mission. Well, you know, everybody has a cross to bear.
I can't help thinking, Jane, because I'm a girl and I'm a Southern woman. So I can't help but think to myself, you know, how do you prepare for something like that? So what kind of time do you get to pack? I mean, if you will, and how on earth, I know this is just so silly. You're an FBI agent, you're ERT, you're going to Yemen, you're going to be doing very professional things. But like, how do you know, you know, the
what to wear?
Have you ever heard the term ready bag, Francie?
Of course, I know what a go bag is, Jim, but that's what I'm trying to get at. What's in Jane's go bag?
It wasn't, you know, not terribly glamorous, because you do have to go from a very practical perspective. So you had your beautiful ERT cargo pants, which are not terribly flattering, but incredibly effective. You know, they're khaki pants with a whole bunch of, you know, pockets on them. And so I packed as many pairs of those that I had, and a number of, because we knew it was going to be really hot, right? So, you know, Yemen in October is about 110 degrees.
Ouch.
And so, it was hot. So it's funny, in looking at pictures that I have from the Cole, I pretty much did wear the same thing every day. I remember going and buying some white t-shirts, and I had a little bucket hat I wore every day, but I was prepared. White t-shirt, khaki pants, bucket hat every day. But then, of course, you'd have to take all of your other things. And there may have been a bar room or two along the way that we visited. So one has to be fashionable as they can for those settings. But yeah, you pretty much were able to bring, to what I can remember, you know, you had to make sure whatever you brought, you were carrying yourself. So it was really, you know, one good size duffel bag, and we were prepared. So you had to get ready that Thursday night. It happened on a Thursday, I recall. And so got ready Thursday night. And then the crack of dawn Friday, we made our way down to, I believe it was Fort Dix, and ultimately then went to Andrews Air Force Base, where we boarded a military aircraft and were transported from Andrews to Germany, and then spent a night there, and then made it to Yemen on Sunday. So that in and of itself was a journey.
So two questions. One is, Yemen being located in the Middle East, is it a dry country or a non-dry country?
Well, it depends where you are. So we stayed at the beautiful Aden Hotel, which did have a bar that was frequented pretty much on a daily basis by certain FBI agents, who shall remain anonymous.
And the other question is, did you run into an FBI agent named Tim Clemente while you were there?
You know, I don't think I did. I don't think I met your brother. So
okay,
I'm
because
sorry.
He was probably the guy with the sniper rifle hanging out on the top of some roof somewhere overlooking.
Or more likely he was sitting in the bar the whole time, and we just think he was sitting there with a sniper rifle. I think that's why it's a Clemente thing.
I don't know if I'll take that with a grain of salt or sand or something.
Sand. That's one of the, a lot of sand.
One of the unsolved mysteries of this case, perhaps.
That's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, now you're there. You're situated. You got all your stuff. You actually, I assume, at some point, have to go to the crime scene. And I would imagine that a massive United States destroyer, right? Wasn't it a destroyer?
Yes. Yep.
That has a gaping hole in it and, I don't know, maybe is in danger of sinking or something. And I imagine that would be a rather large and unusual crime scene. What did it feel like when you got there?
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
When we arrived into Yemen, we flew in on a Sunday evening and it was dark when we landed. And we had one of those rather unconventional landings, which was essentially straight down. And it's not the kind of landing that we all enjoy on Delta Airlines. But so it was dynamic, right? We land at the airport in Aden and the local authorities aren't necessarily all that glad to be there, for us to be there. But we were met, we actually may have met your brother that night because we were ultimately met once we finally got through some of those issues at the airport and a lot of, I think, negotiation and back and forth. And then we were got in a number of vans and were, you know, immediately taken to our hotel under, you know, under heavy guard because it was, you know, they didn't know the threat, what the threat was at that time. So the following morning, we're at the Aden Hotel. And we have a briefing early in the morning, and John O'Neill, who, Tim, I know, I'm sure you knew John. Mm-hmm. John was there with Tim Caruso and some other leaders from the Washington field office were there. We had a briefing about what we were going to do. But to your point, yeah, here's this huge ship, Navy ship, that is, you know, had been at the port taking on fuel when it was attacked, this fueling station. And so you don't really know what to expect when you get there. So again, we leave the hotel, we take as much gear as we can with us, and then we make our way to this, to the part of the harbor. But then you get to the harbor and you can see the ship is probably, I don't know, 200-300 yards out in the harbor because it's still at this fueling station. So you get there and you have to take all your stuff. And then we have to get on a smaller boat and make our way out to the fueling port. So that's another up and down and up and down on these other little boats. And we finally get out there. Then we get to the fueling port. And that's where you really can see the enormity of what we're dealing with, you know, the incredible size of the ship. And, you know, you're like a little, you know, peanut compared to it. But then you had to board the ship. And literally, there was like a gangplank that you had to walk on to get to board the ship. So you know, most of us think about boarding a ship. It's a cruise ship and it has a nice wide walkway and it has railings and all these other nice things. You know, not so much. You had to walk up a pretty steep and fairly narrow, essentially gangplank. And then we also, and it was oily, it was greasy because you're on a fueling platform. And then, of course, you had to carry all the treasures that you brought with us and all our equipment up there. So by the time we finally got onto the coal and had all our equipment up there and was able to really, you know, further assess the situation, it was pretty, not overwhelming. I don't want to say impressive, because impressive is a word you like to use for good things. But it was, you know, the impact was just so grave. And it was hard to, you know, kind of hard to put it all together, recognizing that, you know, 17 sailors had been murdered through that attack. But the, you know, to your point as well, too, there were concerns. Was the ship going to sink? There was a gaping hole in the side of the ship. You know, some of the young sailors worked tirelessly 24 hours a day to make sure that the ship stayed afloat, and really for the safety and well-being of all the sailors.
I'm really interested in, you know, we're so steeped in these, especially because we're doing a project right now where lots of people have been talking about it. I want to be mindful, though, that there may be a lot of our listeners who are not familiar with the coal bombing. So Could you just give us a quick overview of what happened that brought you there? I mean, you talked about murdered sailors, so I mean, I think that's obvious, but like, what happened?
Sure. No, it's a really important story that people need to be reminded of. So what happened was, on the morning of October 12th, as I mentioned before, the USS Cole was docked in the port of Aden and it was refueling. And so that morning, about 10:45 in the morning, a small boat was approaching the USS Cole. And you have to think about that time as well, too. This is 2000. This is before September 11th. Certainly terrorism was a concern overseas, but really the military hadn't experienced anything like this. So this small, I'll just call it like a jetty, but a small boat started coming towards the USS Cole. And they didn't come in a threatening manner. You know, it's my understanding they came in a peaceful manner and may have been waving and sending greetings. However, they came right alongside the USS Cole across the ship. They knew, they must have known, that was part of their plan. They knew where they were heading for. And when they got next to the ship, they detonated the boat they were in. They were suicide bombers who detonated their boat, which was laden with explosives. But they hit the USS Cole right in the area of they call it the mess hall. Most of us would call it the cafeteria, right near the cafeteria. And they also struck the ship right at the time when many, many sailors were in line to get their lunch, or the chow line, I think they call it. So it was a very well-planned attack. They executed it. Al-Qaeda ultimately was responsible. They executed it with their precision as planned. And through that attack, they murdered 17 sailors, most of them young kids that were, you know, serving our country. And then injured many more people at the same time. And of course, did tremendous damage to the ship itself.
Well, I mean, I remember that, Jane. I remember it happening. I remember seeing some of the images. And you mentioned a few minutes ago that you have at least a picture or two of yourself. It's one of the things we like to post for our listeners. So we can cut this out if your answer is no, by the way. But we'd love to have a picture of that if you have something we can post on our Facebook site. I'm completely distracted also by the idea of being a woman back in 2000 in a country like Yemen. I mean, you're already under guard. So as FBI agents, you're already in danger. But I'm always struck when I talk to female FBI agents and prosecutors who've traveled to some of these countries that don't exactly have a high opinion of women, or that have never even seen women in roles like you were filling there with the FBI. So I'd like to know what that was like. Did you get a special briefing? How many women were there with you? And did you think about it as you were moving around Yemen while you were there?
Yeah, so interesting. So in total, gosh, there were probably 50 FBI agents in total there. So we had agents from the Washington field office. They arrived the day before us, either late Saturday or Sunday, they arrived. And then I was part of the larger New York contingent. And so I'd say there's about 50 of us. Maybe there were 8 or 9 women. So, you know, there were a fair number of us. So you know, we really stayed my part of the trip. It was, we were really at the hotel and at the crime scene, at the hotel and crime scene. So we did not go anywhere really outside of that without, I didn't have any reason to go those places. In the hotel, we were treated very well by the hotel staff. We were somewhat of an oddity. It's kind of funny, when the guys would call for towels, they wouldn't get them. But when we called for towels from our room, boom, room service was right up there to help us. But there weren't enough hotel rooms. And so actually we had four of us girls in one room. I think four were in another room.
Wow.
So it was, you know, it's an interesting, you know, environment. You know, whenever you do travel, I always try to be respectful of the local customs and the beliefs and the values of those countries. But when we were in the hotel, which is, you know, again, where we spent most of our time, that was a pretty Western environment. But there were things that we had to do throughout that trip. And we were reminded by the ambassador many times that we, the ladies, had to be mindful of what we wore and how we behaved to maintain what she described as our diplomatic relationships with that country. So she was not happy with some of us FBI ladies, because we tucked our shirts into our jeans, which was pretty revolutionary.
Well, but again, why was that? Just because it showed off your figure or something?
I don't know. But that's the custom, right? So in that part of the world, so if we had been out in the community, if we had, but we were, you know, inside, you know, this Western hotel, but whatever, I don't want to digress, because that's not necessarily important to the whole story. But it was, we were really lucky. All the members of the FBI's hostage rescue team were there with us, the HRT. They did an amazing job helping to keep us safe. New York SWAT team was there. Washington Field was there. And it was just great the way people really looked out for each other. But I felt, despite that environment, felt really, really good that we had such great people there to protect us.
Well, one of them was apparently my brother, Tim. He was on the flight the day before you.
Okay.
And I don't know if you've read about it in Ali Safan's book, but there's also been some articles about the standoff that occurred there, because obviously they were getting off a plane with a lot of weaponry. And my brother Tim, not Ali Safan, is the one that actually went out with a case of water under his arm. It was 120 degrees.
Yeah.
They were, the guys with the guns that were pointing at them were passing out. It was so hot. Mm-hmm. And it was a multi-hour standoff while negotiations happened.
Yeah.
And he went out and basically walked up to the leader, unscrewed a cap from a bottle, drank some and gave it to him. The guy looked at him for a while, eventually took the water, and then Tim went around and handed it out to all the other guys. And after about 5 minutes of that, they said, "All right, come on off the plane and bring your guns."
Yeah,
so that was a hell of a day, because it could have gone very differently.
Oh, for sure. No, and really that landscape that was set by your brother's efforts and the other folks there was really something else. Because it was not a warm welcome when we necessarily arrived on Sunday, but it was much better than that. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. So there you are. You're walking up an oily gangplank. I can only think to myself that, Jim, the Louboutins that I've acquired since I left the Department of Justice would never have flown there in Yemen, Jane. So I imagine you were wearing dreaded, sensible shoes. But that's all I can think about. I get distracted by crazy things like that. So there you are walking up the gangplank, literally walking up a gangplank into a ship that's just been bombed. What do you see when you get on?
Yeah. So, you know, again, the what you really saw too were all these sailors, right? So now maybe we're 72 hours after the bombing. They were still confined to the coal. They hadn't been able to necessarily move as many sailors off as the coal as they wanted to. It was hotter than Haiti. It stunk. They didn't have enough, you know, there's no air conditioning. There was limited power, limited air conditioning, uh-huh. Limited facilities. So a lot of the sailors are literally, you know, sleeping on the deck. They've got these kind of makeshift tents and what have you. And they're dealing with this traumatic event that took place. Many of them are working to keep the ship afloat. Some of them are working to keep it as clean as possible and to feed people. So all of that is happening. So there's that weird dynamic of all that kind of buzz, and there's kind of that energy that existed there as well too. But it was, you know, then you would actually go to the actual impact area where the divers were working, and we, you know, started to assess how we would gather the evidence and, you know, set up a small, you know, work area downstairs. But you really couldn't help but be struck by these sailors, many of them, you know, late teens, early 20s, that were in a place far, far away from home. You know, their friends had been murdered, and it was a hard time for them. So it was really great for them, I think, to see us. You know, we were an impressive group, right? You know, in total, and they were eager to assist us in any way they could. And I think we were also just a great distraction from them emotionally as well, too, during a really difficult time.
That's great. And I have to believe that this crime scene also included underwater exploration, because obviously if the boat was outside and there was a massive explosion, I imagine that boat did not survive very well and sank. So
yeah. So
how did you deal with that?
So there were a lot of, you're absolutely right. You know, there was parts of the small, this we'll just call it the skiff that came alongside of it. So we recovered many pieces of that, like the fiberglass that was made from. We recovered hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of that spread throughout the deck of the Cole. But then also there were divers. There were U.S. Navy divers that really did the majority of the work inside the water. I think they call them like mud suit divers. But anyway, there was a very large naval dive team. The New York dive team was there as well, too. I don't know if they ever actually were certified to be able to go in those kind of conditions as well, too. But then they worked with them about, you know, what we were looking for. How do you recover, you know, evidence from underwater? What are we looking for? What's important? Right. And so the divers also played an important role in, you know, trying to, I'm sure, to, you know, shore up the ship as well, too, to further assess the damage to that. So, no, it was important that we recover evidence from the water to the extent possible, and to also recover evidence on the deck of the ship.
So my question is about the dive operation. Do you have any idea how deep the water was? I mean, I'm just thinking to myself, it's a port, so maybe it's sort of shallow, but it's also a major port, so it has to hold these really heavy ships. Did divers go all the way to the bottom to look for evidence, or was it all just mostly there at the surface? Yeah.
No, they certainly, to recover evidence properly, they would have to go down as deep as they could. I have no idea the depth of that, and I couldn't probably answer that very well. But they spent, you know, just days and days in the water looking for physical evidence, and also, you know, an effort to identify the remains of the suicide bombers as well, too, anything affiliated with them.
Jane, this is an incredibly intriguing story, and I'm sure you have so much more to tell us. We're going to have to continue next week because we're out of time. But everybody, you're going to want to hear, believe me, you're going to want to hear what Jane has to say and the things she goes through in this really amazing and harrowing case of the bombing of the U.S. Cole in Yemen. So, Jane, thank you for being here. And we'll see you next week. Until next time, thank you for listening to Best Case, Worst Case. Signing out.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba. And hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness to Light can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's d2l.org.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.